Election College, episode number 253, Chester Arthur, part one.
Let's throw a political party. Face it, the political scene sucks, but did it always? It's time for Election College, and class is in session. Now, your hosts, Jason Goff and Ben Smith.
Hey, Jason, I think that a man with two first names should not be trusted. But that's beside the point, because a man with two first names was trusted as the president of our United States. That's Chester Arthur. And guys, I'm just kidding about the whole two first name things. Don't be offended, please.
Yeah, don't be, because Ben totally named his kids last name, first names.
That's true.
I guess my kid has a last name, first name too.
Yeah.
So confusing.
We're just, you know, we like to break the norm, but, you know. So anyway, Chester Arthur, Chester A. Arthur is how we see it written a lot of times. The A stands for Alan. So technically he had three first names. He was born in October of 1829 in Vermont, and he was born of a English and Welsh descent, and his great-grandfather, Uriah Stone, was in the Continental Army during the American Revolution. So kind of getting to the point now where presidents' grandfathers were fighting to change the country, and I guess that's kind of a cool legacy.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of interesting about his dad, William, because he was raised Presbyterian, but then he became a Free Will Baptist minister. Mm-hmm. And get this, he had to go from church to church because he was a very outspoken abolitionist. So not only did he leave all of the stuff that Presbyterians, you know, frozen, chosen and all that, but then he went to become a Free Will Baptist minister.
Crazy.
And he was a staunch abolitionist, which made him kind of unpopular in some of the churches too. So that's the reason they went church hopping a lot.
Yeah. So they're moving all around. And in 1828, they moved to Fairfield, where Chester is born. And there was actually a physician who was also a family friend. You know, in those days, everybody in town was a family friend and maybe a physician as well, who helped during his birth and helped deliver Chester. And his name was Chester, too. So Chester was for a buddy who helped deliver him, and Alan was for his grandfather. And, of course, Dad's job took them around to multiple other places after Chester was born, and they finally settled down in Schenectady, New York. And Arthur ends up having about seven different siblings who make it through to adulthood. Of course, you know, it wasn't always very possible that all the children would make it through to adulthood, but he had seven who did, and they had various accomplishments and whatnot. But the fact that they moved all around all the time was kind of used against Chester Arthur in some political ways. And later on, people would say that, you know, he wasn't a native born citizen and he may have born in Canada or something like that. Of course, none of those rumors really took hold, but they were certainly used against him as part of that story of theirs where they moved all around.
Yeah, I want to see that birth certificate.
That's right.
So Arthur spending his, I wouldn't call him Arthur, like that's his first name.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have thought of that unless you weren't harping on the whole last name, first name thing. But yeah, he spends his childhood all over New York State. And his teachers, one of his first teachers said that as a boy, he was, quote, frank and open in manners and genial in disposition, which means that he was a total rebel. No, it doesn't mean that.
Yeah. And while he's in school, he kind of starts getting into politics and gets interested in the Whig Party. And then he joins up with some other folks who were Whigs and gets in support of Henry Clay. And then he even gets in a fist fight with some kids who are supportive of James K. Polk. So he was pretty much political from an early age. So later, Arthur ends up enrolling at Union College in Schenectady in 1845. And he, you know, kind of takes on a classical curriculum and stuff like that. And he ends up being in the debate society. He gets elected to a fraternity. This is more like an honor society. And he also ended up serving as a teacher during his winter breaks during that time. He ends up graduating in 1848, becomes a full-time teacher. And of course, just you know what's coming next. He heads off to pursue an education in law.
Oh, man. All of these guys who are lawyers becoming presidents.
That's right.
What's up with that? So he takes up the family mantra and moves all over the place. So finally, after moving all over New York State, he ends up settling in New York City to read law. And he becomes known as an abolitionist lawyer. And yeah, he's got some crazy court cases that we're going to talk about here in just a moment, where he is definitely defending the abolitionist cause. The firm that he joins, there's a guy named John Jay, who's one of the lawyers. And he's actually the grandson of, you know, John Jay. Go figure. And they were pursuing a habeas corpus action against Jonathan Lemon, who was a Virginia slaveholder. And he was passing through New York State with his 8 slaves. And in this court case, Lemon versus New York, Culver, who was Arthur's cohort, argued that New York law did not permit slavery. And if you are a Virginian and you're bringing you and your slaves through New York, well, guess what? Your slaves can go free. And they won the case.
Yeah, and so there's another civil rights case where Arthur is involved, and it's in 1854. He's the lead attorney representing Elizabeth Jennings Graham. And you may remember hearing about that case. She was denied being allowed to have a seat on a streetcar just because she was black. And he wins. And of course, that verdict leads to New York streetcars no longer being desegregated, or actually no longer being segregated, being desegregated, as a matter of fact. So quite the accomplishment there, and of course had lots of ramifications in the future as well. And that's similar to some other cases we see as the future moves forward, but you know, not till we get into the 1900s, really.
Yeah. So there is Chester Arthur. He's in New York defending all kinds of good causes when in 1856 he begins courting Ellen Herndon. And she's the daughter of a naval officer. And they quickly became engaged and got married.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of 3 and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Arthur ends up starting a new partnership, a law partnership, with his friend Harry Gardner. And they traveled to Kansas, and they actually considered purchasing land and setting up a practice there. If you remember, in the 1850s, you had that whole Bleeding Kansas episode going on. And speaking of episodes and Bleeding Kansas, we have an episode about that. So you can go back and listen to that and just know that Chester Arthur, he was there.
So hop up into the Civil War. It's 1861, and Chester Arthur gets appointed to the staff of Governor Morgan, and he's appointed there as the engineer in chief. And it's not really that big of a deal. The engineer in chief during peacetime is kind of a formality, I guess. And then the Civil War breaks out in April, and everybody's really forced to come up with these armies that are just gigantic. Everybody has to send everybody, basically. So he gets commissioned as the brigadier general and gets assigned to the militia's quartermaster department. Well, he is really efficient. He's incredible at making sure that all the troops get housed, that they get outfitted, that they get all their gear and everything. And he gets promoted again because of that. He gets promoted to the Inspector General of the State Militia, and then later to Quartermaster General in 1862, July of that year. So he just keeps moving forward and progressing through the ranks. He never quite hits the front. He never is on the front line or anything. But at one point, he did travel down to inspect some New York troops near Fredericksburg, Virginia. And this is right after this is during the Peninsula Campaign. And there were points where he got pretty close to the front lines, but never actually saw combat.
For the time being, he goes back to New York, and a Democrat becomes governor of New York, which is not good if you're a Republican and you're appointed to a pretty sweet position, like being an engineer in chief. So he pretty much lays low for a little while and plays the political game and moves up in the Republican Party. And if you know anything about New York politics, if you're involved in any political party, you're going to be part of a machine. And that's exactly what he was doing. He was working his way up in New York Republican machine politics. So Arthur is doing really well as far as his career goes, politically, professionally, as well as his marriage. Tragedy hits the Arthur household when their son, William, dies at the age of 3, just suddenly. And they took this very hard, as you can imagine. And they did have another son named Chester Arthur Jr., and they spoiled him rotten. And he ended up living a pretty spoiled, rotten life. And then they also had a daughter named Ellen. And they both, Chester Jr. and Ellen, live into adulthood. Governor Morgan ends up getting elected to the United States Senate, and Arthur gets hired by Thomas Murphy, who is a Republican politician who is also a friend of our buddy Boss Tweed. Now, you know Boss Tweed, right? Tammany Hall, they're Democrats. But Murphy was a hatter, and he sold goods to the Union Army way back when, and Arthur represented him in Washington. The two become associates and get busy with the whole business of machine politics. And in the presidential election of 1864, Arthur and Murphy raised funds from the Republicans in New York to get Abraham Lincoln's inauguration funded in 1865.
So, yeah, machine politics are at their height, and we continue to see Chester Arthur progress through different things. At certain times, he's laying low pretty well and making certain that he's not going to, you know, put his head up and get it chopped off or anything. But there are times where he's very much active in the political scene and working the machine. And, you know, Tammany Hall is coming hard against them as well. So he does move up through and ends up being appointed as the collector, where he, you know, is really in charge of a lot of different jobs and compensation of those jobs. And his salary is about $6,500. But, you know, there's always some more money there. So his income ends up being like $50,000, which is way more than the president's salary, and definitely enough for him to have kind of a lavish lifestyle. And, you know, Arthur is still a popular guy, and people don't necessarily know that there's some crazy stuff going on behind the scenes. And he has a good reputation. People like him, at least, you know, for the most part.
Unless you are a Republican president from Ohio named Rutherford B. Hayes, who is very much not about the business of machine politics. It comes to a head in 1876 when Hayes, who is very much not a machine politician, and Roscoe Conkling are vying for the Republican candidacy. Well, we know how that happens. It ends up Hayes wins. And it doesn't look too good for Arthur because he's part of the whole stalwart faction of the Republican Party. In 1880, Conklin and his fellow stalwarts decide that they are going to secure the nomination for President Grant, which they are successful in doing.
Yeah, and just a quick note there. Arthur really, you know, has a lot of triumphs during this time. And as this election is coming up in 1880, you know, they're getting a lot of planning done. But in January of 1880, his wife does die suddenly while he's away. And, you know, he's obviously devastated. And at times there's some evidence that he may have had some guilt, maybe for not being around as much and things like that. And he ends up never remarrying in the future. So keep that in mind as you move forward, that he's now kind of flying solo.
Yeah. And that brings us up to the next election, which we will talk about in the next episode.
If you want to say, hey, you know, just tell us hi or something like that, you can go over to our social media channels, send us a message or something, and you know, we'll respond. We're those kind of guys. We really try to interact with you as much as we can.
Yeah, we're real people too.
That's right.
And speaking of real people, we love it when we get new reviews on iTunes. It helps more awesome people just like you get word about the podcast. So head over to electioncollege.com/iTunes and you will be magically redirected to the place where you can give your review.
That's right. And we really appreciate all of you who have left us a review already. If you haven't yet, it's definitely important to do it on iTunes, even if you don't listen on iTunes. And if you're listening on Overcast, there's a little star you can press and it'll recommend us to other people. That would be great if you did that as well. We're really big fans of, you know, being recommended. So who isn't, I guess?
Who isn't?
Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll pick it up next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.